Hi, this is Paul, and this is my second conversation with Luke. And, well, Luke, I don't know, you introduced yourself quite a bit last time, and I usually put the link up in the little exclamation point on top. So if you want to see the first conversation I did with Luke, you can find that. But here we are again. What's up, Luke? You're not on Twitter anymore.
No. I don't know. It's been a few months now, and it's been great. I honestly haven't missed it at all. I feel much more sane.
It's a little insane.
Yeah, well, and I mean, it can be a good thing. It really served a nice purpose in my life when I was kind of things very similar to people who call you talk about. You know, it was a way for me to find and relate to people who have similar interests and passions and things. And but I just found, I don't know, it served its purpose, I think, and it was creating more heat than light for me, I think. And so I just decided to shut it down.
Good. There are many days when I also want to shut down social media, get off Facebook, get off Twitter, but I've got all these connections now through it. And it's kind of like, so I haven't done that yet.
No, I understand that for sure.
So what's on your mind for today?
Okay. So I wanted to start by saying a couple things. I'm going to forget her name. So who is your, the wonderful woman you spoke with from Silicon Valley?
Oh, Karen.
Karen. Yes. So at the beginning, when she was describing the way that her mind works, perfect. Those 3 points, which were, I think, she's an external processor for sure. I'm the exact same way. And that she's also at the same time trying to lay a foundation or a basement. She wants to give, this is how I describe it. I want to give the context and the thinking and the journey of every thought I've ever had so that you understand me and where I'm coming from. But that just usually ends up confusing people because it's too much information. And then the interconnectedness of all things. I really relate to all of those. So in my discussion with you, I have a few main topics I want to hit. I've written some notes to try to hopefully be intelligible. And so I wrote this sentence. And so we'll see. Hopefully, I think it will make sense to you, particularly in lately you've been talking about technology in a way that is right in line with my thinking. And so I have just this sentence that kind of is a broader summary of kind of everything I'd like to say or talk about and get your thoughts on. So, one more preface. Sorry. See, here I go again. The basement. I'm sure it comes across, you know, I'm on my way to becoming Eastern Orthodox, and it probably comes across as I rail against the West a lot. And that's true in a sense. And like you and I have spoken about, some of that is woundedness. Like Tim Keller talks about in his Meaning of Marriage book, woundedness. And I've found that to be a really helpful category for me. And I'm sure some of that's true. You know, there's personal pains, and then there's broader systematic pains that I see within evangelicalism that I think could be fixed. And I feel like there's not a lot of desire to want to see inside and look and see those problems. And so that just pains me. And so anything that I say about the West, I just want to preface this to say that I don't think it's, my critique isn't universal. It's more about, I think, the broader way of seeing the world that I think is inherent to the West. And it's not even Western Christianity, it's the broad West.
Universal. That's very broad.
But this is my caveat to that, is I don't think that it manifests in every individual or institution. Like, I think there are individuals and institutions who won't fall under my criticism, but I think that's because they're living contrary to their way of seeing and profession. They're enacting something different than their broader worldview. But I think they're going to be the exceptions rather than the norm.
Okay.
So anyhow, This is the sentence. The modernist West has idolized the intellect and is on the way toward complete disembodiment via technologies and tools and transactionalism toward technological battle.
Well, hang on. I'm typing as we go. The modernist West has idolized the intellect and is on its way towards complete disembodiment
via technologies, tools, and transactionalism toward technological babble.
Babble with a capital B.
Yep.
Now, don't you think, you know, if you look at China or Korea or Japan, they're doing it too?
Yep. Yeah, I do. And I would, so technology isn't, it's not completely connected to the West, but I would say the spirit of technology that I'm going to try to articulate in this discussion with you, I think is specifically tied to the West. And I would say we've exported it through industry, through globalism, through consumerism. But I would say that's because all those things are inextricably tied and connected.
This reminds me of Slate, Star, Codex, How the West Was Won. Do you read that blog at all?
No.
I'll put the link in the notes here. He talks about universal culture in the way, you know, Coca-Cola takes over the world. There's something that happened in, you know, after colonialism with the spread of Western values that have taken over the world in many ways, that very much get into this. And it comes out of modernism and the West. But when you look at, for example, what China is doing in terms of their morality scores, keeping morality scores like keeping credit scores, and there's obviously a different background in the Far East with respect to a lot of this. But I don't know that it's, and if you talk about Western Christianity, it's certain, you know, they're Eastern. Western versus Eastern Christianity, there's a very big difference there. But it's beyond, I think by using the word West, it's isolating it to something that it's certainly far broken out of the West.
And I agree.
We have no anticipation that Africa or South America will resist it either, for that matter. So I would think about it more in the lines of what Scott Alexander talks about in his piece, How the West Was Won, universal culture. Because it basically says here, Western culture is no more related to the geographical West than Western medicine. People who complain about Western culture taking over their country always manage to bring up Coca-Cola. But in what sense is Coca-Cola culturally Western? And Ani goes from there, because what happens is that there's sort of a globalism that has taken over, and some of this mindset that I understand you pointing to has in many ways taken over this, you know, infiltrated through this globalism and has become sort of a necessary part of this globalism.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's and this is part of my, this gets into part of my connection of concerns. I mean, I have Luddite kind of tendencies, and I'm a romantic. So, I mean, it's easy for me to romanticize that. I think that's a little reductionistic and simplistic. But this, maybe this will help clarify a little. So I was talking to my wife about this, and I think this is a good grouping, but I kind of see technological babble as a combination of these four things that are, I think, like I was saying, inextricably tied. So individualism, progress, technology, and materialism / consumerism. And so what I think what you're talking about with the global culture and how we've exported it and how it's in China and Taiwan and all of that, that's very true. And I think we've done that through technology and consumerism, materialism primarily. But I would say like the broader worldview categories and ways of viewing the world, I think all of those things are connected. And I think where it's different is the East is not as individualistic yet. They're materialistic. I mean, the whole world is kind of because of Hollywood and the internet and globalism and all these things. But but my concern with it all is that it's bound up in the intellect. I mean, this kind of gets at, cause I all came here through intellectual study and church things. And I think it's much bigger than just Christianity and church, even though, I mean, like Jordan Peterson says, I agree, the deepest categories are theological. And so even though you can see these things in the secular world and politics and stuff, those are just superficial manifestations as far as I'm concerned. These are really, it reminds me of almost, and I made a comment, I was critical of, you did a video, it's one of your non-discussion videos recently where you were quoting, you played a little of, who's the apologist guy that your buddy's with and you follow? You start off the video with it, and he was talking about...
Glenn Scrivener.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and he was talking about being ruled by principalities, and we are not masters in our own house, you know?
Which was right out of Peterson's... That was a big point in Peterson's Why I Dare Not Say I Believe in God video. So that wasn't from Glenn, actually. That was from Jordan.
Okay. But it seemed to me that he affirmed that a little bit, that we are essentially committed to principalities and rulers that are bigger than us, and that we are in some way in submission to. Maybe he wasn't saying that. Maybe I'm conflating me and Jordan.
The Peterson point in that video was much more that we are not in control of ourselves. Peterson doesn't really make the principalities and powers argument. Glenn might, because Glenn's obviously a Christian, but
well, yeah, he wouldn't use that language, but I think he would say, like when he says in his answer to, I mean, I've heard him say this in multiple places, but when he'll say something like, you know, how do you know what you want? You have no idea who you are. I mean, what he's essentially saying is it's in the same way that you talk about how, like, there are things your mind knows that you don't know. I mean, there's things that you know and commitments that you have and desires and passions that are bigger than your conscious awareness. I mean, that's the elephant and the rider.
Yeah.
But the problem with when you've idolized the intellect is you've put the rider on the top of the monarchical vision, on the top of the hierarchy.
Right.
And that's just foolish. It's a really, really bad idea. And I actually think, so my whole like technology, consumerism, materialism, I think a really simple way to illustrate it is it's Asgard. It's Sauron. It's the ring. It's Tolkien. I mean, it's the difference between Asgard and Hobbiton. And I think we're headed there. The church, I think the Western church, and I mean, you talk about this, it's like the mega churches and how we model things more based off of business than other things. Not all churches are doing it that way, but I think that spirit is deeply within us as Americans, and as Westerners. And this gets into, one of the big things that was my catalyst for all this is I was wanting to talk to you about grace and works, and the difference of, and I'm not as well versed in this. I just have intuitions about it, but, and I got this from, Nathan Jacobs, in listening. I don't know if you ever listened. I think I shared with you his podcast with Hank Hanegraaff.
I didn't listen to that. I'll want to. That could, 'cause that would be very interesting.
So it's on the sophistication of the early church fathers. And he articulates incredibly well kind of the history of – he has a few sections in there, and he contrasts East and West and how they see things. And he says one of the reasons a lot of Western Christians tend to struggle and have a hard time conceptualizing the way that the East – I don't even like to say paradigm or worldview. It's a way of seeing. It's deeper than that. They see the world differently because, and he says it's hard for Westerners to get their heads around because all their frameworks, all their questions, everything comes out of Augustinian assumptions, comes out of Augustinian foundations, and they can't really get deeper than that because everything is rooted in Augustine. And he said, that's never been in the East. The East, it's not that they're unaware of Augustine or they don't value him or they don't think he had good things, but there's certain things about his framework that have never been fundamental assumptions in the East. And so the West will come to a lot of discussions and they'll be like talking about salvation and they'll be like, well, the East thinks of it with justification and sanctification differently. And I'm like, those aren't even categories in the East. Those are coming out of Western assumptions. And I think it's really hard. This is my struggle with a lot of these discussions. We're never going back far enough. Like we got to get to the root of the problem, which to me is the big divergence started at Augustine.
It's, you know, I've been reading this book on, I can't pull up the title off the top of my head, this book on Erasmus and Luther.
Yeah,
which has a lot of what's sort of nice about that book. It has a lot of other church history. Look at Jerome. Jerome was a very interesting guy, a contemporary of Augustine. It's you know, part of what I suspect we're going to see, and we're seeing it now, interestingly enough, sort of via Jordan Peterson, with Jonathan Peugeot, Nathan Jacobs, and the rise of the rise of the visibility of the Eastern Church in the West, is going to open up a lot of new conversations, because for the most part, the Eastern Church hasn't had a very big part of the broader Christian conversations, at least in the United States. And that's changing. It's going to be, you know, it's hard to appreciate how cut off the East was from the West for how long and what formative years. You know, it's sort of like a divorce happened in a household and the kids went to live with dad and they never knew mom. And so suddenly you get reacquainted with mom in your 30s. It's going to be it's going to be a very interesting conversation because you don't relive those formative years.
Right.
And you know, one of the things that I've been struck by, and I just mentioned to you before, I had my first ever Zoom mishap and that I had a really wonderful conversation with Nathan Jacobs this morning that I thought was just stellar, and he enjoyed it as well. And for some reason, Zoom did not record. And so there's no getting that conversation back. But
it's the devil.
One of the things that I have thought a lot about is why, you know, Peugeot, Father David that I spoke with earlier, Nathan, all of these individuals coming out participating in this conversation. Somebody sent me a link to St. Elijah's Church somewhere in the Midwest, where they've got this ongoing class on YouTube about mystagogy,
yeah,
Gospel of John. And since I'm doing this Gospel of John in my adult Sunday school class, the, you know, as is often the case, the immigrants sort of bring the church over, but it's the, you know, it's the converts, it's the former evangelicals,
or right,
the former Protestants,
right,
who are now using YouTube, using cinema. This is going to be a very interesting chapter in church history, because, of course, the church that, boy, I don't know if Jonathan will listen to this, but I don't want to say anything out of school. The church that, when Jonathan Peugeot goes to the Eastern Church, he is having a different experience than those children of immigrants who brought the church over.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And so just like the churches that grew out of the immigrant churches in America became, this has happened in the Christian Reformed Church. I was not an immigrant. The Christian Reformed Church that I express in some ways is very different from the Christian Reformed Church of my grandparents that they brought over from the offskiting in the Netherlands. And so, I mean, this is going to be a very dynamic situation. And even just the fact that, you know, here we have the Orthodox Church in some ways proselytizing, and I use that word guardedly, via YouTube. There's no disentangling from the technology. There really isn't. And so in some ways, you know, if you don't want to be tainted by the technology, stay off YouTube and Twitter, yeah, and Facebook. And so this is going to be very interesting to see how this stuff plays out in America. America's right, going to change the Orthodox for the better and for the worse, probably.
So there, I have a couple of thoughts on that. So did you watch all of the Recovering the Nuns videos?
Yes.
Okay. So at the very tail end of that, I didn't know this, but so through your YouTube comments, I've met another guy through your channel who lives in Minneapolis, and we've gotten together since then. And he mentioned to me that toward the end of, I think it's probably the second video, there's a Q&A.
Yes.
And one of the priests that does a Q&A is from another of an OCA temple parish. My priest told me the right word is temple, actually. I spoke with him this week. But in Minneapolis.
Really? Temple?
Yeah. Well, he said, like, the confusion about the church is the body is something that just, he said there's other words in other languages.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he said that's just a confusion where there's only one word for it in English.
That's a significant word, though.
Yeah.
In English. I mean, and that's just it. Once a church gets into another language, it starts to become a different church.
These, hey, fossils, man, yeah, fossils in these words, Barfield.
Yeah.
So a different priest from Minneapolis was one of the questioners, and he was the one who, and I mean, I love people like this, but he was one of the ones who pushed back a little bit with Dr. Jacobs and said, my experience is that I've seen a lot of nuns and people who are apathetic to the faith from within Orthodoxy, from within my own church. My anecdotal experience is that I don't know that it's going to be significantly different. And so, which is a great question. And I think Dr. Jacobs' response was, you know, I haven't looked at that yet, so I can't speak to it. I spoke with my, I'm just going to call him my priest yet, although we're not in the church this week, whom I love, by the way. If there's anyone in Minneapolis, Father Andrew at St. Mary's is one of my favorite people. And I was posing, and I kind of asked him about this, because my intuition, and he agreed with it, was that the Orthodox in America will grow up and become nuns and they'll become apathetic of the faith. But in my opinion, it's not because that's what they're being taught in church. It's because they're Westerners. And it's because they're rejecting religion based on categories that aren't inherent to the Orthodox Church. And I framed it this way, and I think this is true. He agreed with this, is that the way that I really see it is that the Orthodox way of seeing is pre-modern.
Yes, yes.
They never went through modernity.
Yes, yes.
And so, and he even said this because they recently took a trip to Georgia, and he said, if you go out in like remote Georgia, in a place that's a little bit backwards and untouched by technology and Hollywood and consumerism and the modern world, and you go to an Orthodox temple and you attend a liturgy, he said, it's a very different experience there. It's really like stepping in a time machine. And it's almost like we've talked, this is all John Verbeke stuff too. It's like pre-axial age. Yeah. It's if you ask those people if they believe in God, it's like the whole belief doubt thing. Those aren't even categories for them.
Right, right, right.
I mean, they just don't even, and you could, and we can have a talk about whether or not that's good or bad, and you can't go backwards, and we have gone through modernity, and we are conscious, and there is doubt, and there's existential angst. What do we do with that? I agree with you, we can't go back. But my concern is that we really have to address some of these negative issues that I think come out of the West and Augustine and Descartes and dualism, that allow us to live in our disembodied abstractions. Because I think if we don't, there won't be a way forward. There'll be babble.
Yeah, I very much agree with what you said, that it's so hard. And this is where, in some ways, I'm sort of caught between Verveke and Peugeot, because Jonathan, in a sense, says, you know, here's, you know, I don't know that Jonathan says that. So I need to contact Jonathan, have another talk with him, probably a longer one, because, but I do agree with Verveke in that there's in a sense no going back. And this is part of my point with respect to what Scott Alexander calls universal culture. Because part of what, oh boy, this gets so complicated. You know, so the whole icon thing. Actually, Nathan and I talked a little bit about that today too, which again was a really good conversation.
It's been very enlightening for me.
There's so much to this. This is so hard because, again, you don't unlearn what has been built into you, and so then the way forward. You know, one RCA pastor made the comment, you know, before any RCA pastor gets ordained, he should have to renounce Hegel and all his ways. but Hegel at the same time has a point.
Yeah.
That we take all of this stuff. You're not going to reconstitute orthodoxy as it was. And there's no... And I think most Orthodox would agree that that's wrong. Part of the questions I have, and I haven't really looked into this, is why the East was lost. Okay? And that is something that hangs over my head in these conversations, in that the Orthodox Church, and I don't know that period of history anywhere near well enough, but Orthodoxy found a way to incorporate and synthesize the Greeks, and found a very potent way of looking at the world, and managed to convert Greece, Russia, you know, they converted a lot of the East. They also lost the East, and in all fairness, the West lost North Africa too, to Islam. And so at some point, although they also managed to survive communism, and Islam. So we've only begun having this conversation. And so when I watch, for example, I forget the man's name, the pastor in the Mystagogy videos, and I listen to him, it's right away I knew he was raised Protestant. I could tell it just by his turns of phrase. Maybe I should get him on the line one of these days. And
a lot of American priests are.
Yes.
We're Protestant.
Well, and what has interested me is that Father David was for a while in the South Bend CRC.
Yeah.
Nathan Jacobs got his PhD at Calvin Seminary, and he and I talked about that. He had a terrific experience at Calvin Seminary.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that was part of what was fun reaching out to him, because he at least has some awareness of the soup that I come out of, at least part of that. But
Stephen Freeman, who's one of the Father Stephen Freeman, who's one of the best American Orthodox intellectuals that I know of, is brilliant. Like, if you want to, this book, Everywhere Present, is, it's short, and it's orthodoxy in a really simple way. Christianity in a One-Story Universe.
Oh, really? That's what he has? That's interesting.
Yeah, that's the subtitle.
Because
you should check this out too. He did a lecture at Peugeot when he was recently in Seattle. Father Freeman was there also, and he did a lecture on modernity, and it's wonderful.
And I could find that on...
I'll email you. It's on YouTube.
Okay.
I can't remember the name.
Because, you know, part of what I'm wrestling with, just in terms of my own putting the world together, is in fact the relationship between heaven and earth. And I can see, you know, I can see in Jonathan's work a unity of heaven and earth that is, this isn't pre-axial. I mean, the axial age comes before this, but it, you know, it, and that's obviously one of the big crises of the West right now. And you're right that in some ways, you know, the heaven just continues to move further and further out until, you know, Charles Taylor makes this point in terms of providential deism as being a critical step on the way to secularism. Now, of course, Jonathan has this idea of kind of a circularity, that this will come around again.
Yeah.
And maybe it will. None of us will. I mean, we're talking movements that are measured in centuries at this point.
Oh yeah.
And so there's, go ahead.
Are you familiar? So you're familiar with Ken Wilber, and we've talked about spiral dynamics before.
Yep.
I think it's the best visual I have yet, but that is my understanding, best understanding almost, of the movement of time. And there's actually another really good, time is another tricky subject, but this book, Loris, is a wonderful novel. If you want to understand Eugene Vodolazkin.
Got to spell it.
So Vodolazkin. But if you want to, like, this is the beating heart of the Orthodox way of seeing. I mean, he captures, that and Lilith are probably the two books I've resonated with most in my life. George MacDonald's Lilith.
But George MacDonald's Lilith.
Okay. Yeah. But in here he has a section where he talks about I was going to try to find it, but it would be inefficient right now. But it's essentially like a spiral dynamics, that time moves in circles and it comes back around. My concern is, and this is where, to your point of these things take centuries, I agree with you. Like, there is something to kind of the Nietzschean time move. It's a circle. There is some of that, the tail, you know, things come around and around, but it's going somewhere. There's an end, there's a telos. And my concern though is you can do that in a nonviolent way, which is called repentance and reformation. And you can do that in a violent way, which is revolution. This is something I've heard Jonathan talk about. And increasingly, I mean, we see this, and I mean, this gets into the, you know, social justice warrior Peterson stuff, what's going on in the Northeast, you know, at like Evergreen and stopping people on the road and you know, the Antifa and all that stuff. Like, that's the political thing. But all of that, like, that's all spiritual and theological, deeper. And my concern, and this has always been my thing, is like the church that I've experienced in the West is reactionary. Why are we not leading the way, showing people how to fix this stuff by embodying it? We're not. We're contributing to the tribalism on a whole.
Well, the embodiment is, of course, the key thing.
Yes.
Because nobody will be impressed by your way of life if you don't live it.
No. It'll be even grosser because it's hypocrisy.
Right. And part of what, I mean, part of the caving in of a lot of Protestantism now is exactly that point. I think part of, see, this is where language gets tricky,
mm-hmm.
because a lot of Protestantism doesn't go to church. And I,
it's, you know, me,
I
still, and Jesus and my individual relationship.
Well, not
with
even that. It's the atheist. It's the atheists who are in many ways, you know, deeply formed by Christianity in the West. And the, you know, every now and then there's a moment in which, I forget what I was listening to recently or watching, but every now and then there's a moment in which the church, the secular church is revealed and seen. You know, it's almost like in a movie of when you only catch a glimpse of the monster when there's lightning outside, because other than that, everything is just dark.
Yeah.
And the, because, you know, nearly everyone in the culture is deeply formed by Protestantism and the values that came through there.
Yes.
And the Enlightenment.
Even the Catholics and the Orthodox in America,
absolutely,
are Protestant Catholics.
Absolutely. And even I would argue, I mean, part of quite likely why Christianity is growing so well in the East is because in some ways people have already begun to take on the values via this, as Scott Alexander calls, a universal culture. Mm-hmm. And religiously they're just finding that the shoe fits. In some ways. Now, the Christianity that comes out of China that will probably won't be revealed for another 25 or 50 years, this will look quite a bit different from the Christianity we find in the West. But, you know, this stuff is really hard to get a handle on and to really see and talk about. So it's so hard. It's so hard to really sort of get out there.
So this kind of, if we take it back to my initial comment sentence and the idolatry of the intellect, which I think is inherently tied to individualism, because, and this is something you've been working through with all this, is that all knowledge is inherently subjective. We tried to get the subject out. You can't. Everyone is an individual. So therefore, all the knowing that we have until we get hive mind is subjective. And so when you idealize the intellect, this isn't a flattering way to say it, but I've been toying with this idea in my mind that the Protestant church is basically just religious intersectionality. And it eats its own. Because that's the nature of it, because it's all bound up in its own ideas, its own mind, its own orthodoxy, its own binding and blinding. And eventually that breaks down all the way to the individual, which, if you look at the history of Protestantism, it's kind of hard to deny that there's not unending splitting and schism.
Yeah, well, but in all fairness to the Protestants, there's been... That didn't start in the 16th century. And
no.
A better, you know, one of the things that, some of the propaganda, if you read Augustine, you bump into the Donatists. and you bump into the, or you, if you read church history, you bump into the Donatists and you bump into the Arians. And I mean, church history has always been full of splits. And there are other forms of unity beyond organizational unity. Mm-hmm. I mean, this stuff is really hard to talk about. And I, you know, I appreciate what you're saying about Protestantism, but I think the problem with it is that there's more to Protestantism than just that. And when Luther, you know, so this book on Luther and Erasmus is I think quite helpful, yeah. Partly not just because it illuminates some of the missteps of Luther and what became Protestantism, but it also illuminates some of the issues with Erasmus, and that the Protestant Reformation never would have happened without corruption in the church.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just the fact. And
sure.
And I think probably right now the Orthodox Church in America is entering a golden age. And golden ages can last for centuries. And so yeah. I absolutely celebrate that. If the Orthodox Church in America grows to become a major player on the American religious stage, I would love to see that. The challenge to Christianity perpetually is power.
Yes.
And yeah. You saw that in the West with the Roman Catholics. You see that in evangelicalism. I just finished reading Frankie Schaeffer's Crazy for God book,
yeah.
Which was just so much fun. I love that book. I love that yeah. book. You know, some people listening to me say that are just going to cringe because they see that as nothing but betrayal. But yeah. And that doesn't mean I agree with Frank Schaeffer on all right. of his characterizations of everyone. But
yeah.
There's the heart of that book is that in some ways, you know, money and power corrupted, you know, it's the power of corruption.
Yeah.
And there's no end to this. And so
it's the way of the world versus the way of Christ. I mean, ultimately.
It is. Boy, but now we're running out of time and I want to take a little break in here, but you're coming back, right?
Yep.
Okay. Because that's an experiment I really look forward to.
We'll see how it goes.
And I'm thinking, you know, I'm also thinking about, I just had another talk with Mary from the comments section. And some people said, maybe I need to start a sub channel. I'm trying to figure out, you know, how, because there, I don't want to stand in the way. I want to facilitate conversations. I don't want to stand in the way of them, but I'm also not so naive to know that you can just stick people together and have fruitful conversation.
Right. And I think so when you were mentioning that on the tail end of, I think you were mentioning that on the tail end of the, I forget her name again.
Cassidy?
The Silicon Valley girl. But you were talking about it with Karen. Cassidy. Yeah. No matter how well, you know, we think we're motivated, I agree with you. I don't think a lot of people will watch if you're not in it. And so I think that's true. And also I think conversations do need a facilitator because good communication is hard.
Yeah.
And bad, and I don't know. And like I was interacting with someone on your channel in the comments and I said, I don't want to talk anymore because like, I get to the point if I think people assume, if people assume bad faith or say something a little off, I'm just like, I'm done. I'm not going to talk to you. You know, uh-huh. And I think I just don't have time for it, you know, and so I think it can be, conversations can be hard and temperament dynamics, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's a great idea. It's fun. The potential is awesome.
I have to figure this out. Anyway, Luke, this has been great. I'm going to stop now. And the irony is if our four-way conversation doesn't go well, we just teased everybody into frustration because that'll be the epic lost conversation. But
I have high hopes.
All right. We'll see you in a few minutes.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay.